We are on page 452, and Sri Aurobindo is revealing to us the two paths. Of course, traditionally we know the two paths as the path of surrender and the path of tapasya, but that's not what Sri Aurobindo is speaking of. But the two paths, one the path of the gods, which is a path of perfection, of quiet trust in the divine, of surrender, self-giving, aspiration for light and truth and love and peace. And the other is the path of the ego, the titan's path. In the sunlit path, we turn to the divine not for what we can get from the divine, but for what we can give to the divine, how much we can give ourselves to the divine. That's all that the devotee seeks or asks. It is the sunlit way of the soul. But the titan turns to the divine for what he can get out of the divine, primarily power and things which can aggrandize his ego. So we have so many stories in Indian myths where titans have turned to God, and even they are regarded as great bhaktas, but actually they are not bhaktas. Typical story is the story of Ravana. Ravana is not a bhakta. He is turned towards Shiva because he sees in Shiva the embodiment of power. And after he has gathered all the powers, he has made the celestial forces, even the gods, as his slaves. Basically meaning thereby he has mastered them. But he still is in search of a greater power. So first he tries to get Shiva, because he knows here is a tremendous power. He is a worshipper of power. And he discovers that he is no match. He tries to lift Kailash, and just a finger, thumb nail of Shiva is enough to crush his hands. So he knows that he can't just carry it like this. So he tries to please Shiva, because he still wants that power. So some asuras can be very religious. Sri Aurobindo has spoken about it. We may be deceived by appearances, but divine is not deceived. So they can even do entreaties and all kinds of ways and means to please the divine so that they can get that power. So here again he fails. The gods, particularly Ganesha, very cute Ganesha, spoils the plan. But he is in search of that power. So now he knows that from Shiva's side no more power. So he abandons that route. So he looks for another method. Then he discovers that, oh, the power of powers is on earth in the form of Sita. Sita is an embodiment of the Divine Mother. So now he says, here is my chance. There also he is up to his tricks, tries to deceive her, not realizing that the divine is not deceived, and even if he feigns at being deceived, it is his play and leela. So sometimes you may wonder, how did the divine not know? Of course the divine knows, he is not deceived. But he consents to the snare because this is a work to be done and a mission to be fulfilled. So he carries that power, he failed with Shiva, he carries Sita and calls for his destruction. The rest is history. So Sri Aurobindo cautions us, don't take that path. Mother puts it very practically, do not pull, give yourself. Pulling is an egoistic movement. So it's not like we sit for meditation and pull the supramental force. To start with, we cannot. And if something even comes by chance, the vase will get shattered. But if we give ourselves, then the path becomes shorter and easier. And the titan can go to any extent to get that power. We know Ravana used to cut his head. So he can even torture the flesh so that maybe God will get pleased, or he may eventually be blackmailed and eventually be, come to give him a boon. This is the path of the titans. His eyes, blinded and visionless, stare at the sun. The seeker's sight receding from his heart can find no more the light of eternity. So we may look at the divine, even the embodied divine, but depends on by which eyes we are looking. Sri Aurobindo reveals that in the mother. He says, avoid the mind's and trying to understand the ways of the mother. Rather, follow your soul. So if the mind tries to, mind is a blind something. So even if it looks, it cannot look. It is already blinded, or it's blinded by too much of that dazzle, and it cannot really see the eternal. So what is the way? The way is the seeker's heart, not the doubting mind, which is only busy doubting or proving a point, but the seeker's heart. When the seeker's heart is there, the divine reveals himself. He sees the beyond as an emptiness, void of soul, and takes his night for a dark infinite. So he shuts the door to grace, shuts the door to light, to love, and then he says, oh, there is nothing in this world but darkness, darkness, darkness. So he sees nothing else but his own night, and he calls it as the truth. His nature magnifies the unreal's blank and sees in naught the sole reality. He would stamp his single figure on the world, obsess the world's rumors with his single name. His moments center the vast universe. He sees his little self as very God. So these are all the hallmarks of the Titan. So one of them is that, what does he eventually want? He wants everybody to recognize him as God. Even if he turns towards yoga, he wants to be a great yogi, a great tapaswin, to be recognized. This is another way where ambition slips into the spiritual life. And both Sri Aurobindo and the mother have heavily, repeatedly cautioned against it. How dangerous ambition can be. I am a yogi. And now Sri Aurobindo has given us a new word. I am a superman. So thank God we have another superman. And now not just superman, Batman and Iron Man. Breed of poor Batman got hit. That's what happens when you are not the real one. So there was this story, you know, that reminded me of this whole thing. So when recently the man who used to play, you know, become like Batman, dress like Batman to make children happy. So he died just because he had parked his car and it was hit by another car and he didn't realize it. So poor Batman died. So it's so dangerous to feign. So when we feign as Superman, as great sadhakas, as, you know, tapaswins, that's dangerous. It's not dangerous to be what we are, to be mere ordinary mortals, or to be like a child, it's safe. But to feign is dangerous, but he wants that. So Asura, even when he turns to the divine, he wants to be called the greatest bhakta. Even there he brings in competition, jealousy. I am the greatest bhakta. So this is what he does. And of course, there are so many ways he wants to obsess the world's rumors with his single name. His moment center the vast universe. He sees his little self as very God. He sees God as a enlarged image of his being. At one place, even the mother says, it's not me that they love. They love a magnified image of themselves and call it me. So everybody has created an image of the mother. This is what she says. So people who believe in being very harsh and strict disciplinarian have turned mother into very harsh and strict disciplinarian. Mother will punish you. You don't know. And mother, so many times in her writing, with so much love, sweetness, care, she keeps telling, please don't quote me because it's dangerous. She's above all a mother of love, of compassion, and there are so many countless stories. But in the Asura builds God in his own image. That is his image of God. His little eye has swallowed the whole world. His ego has stretched into infinity. Now, of course, fortunately, and most importantly by grace, I think most human beings will not qualify this degree of Asura. But all of us carry within ourselves chinna, 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 chinna Asuras. So every time, that's how the mother put it, that everybody has a little bit of falsehood, a little bit of Hitler inside. So we have to work upon that and not be very happy that, you know, Hitler is dead and gone. Our little Hitler, our little Taliban, that is what we have to work upon. This is what is given to us. So Whenever we see the ego trying to stamp itself on everyone, that means the titan is at play. It's dangerous. We have to become conscious and cautious. Because that's the stride Sri Aurobindo is asking us not to take. In that stride, our winning is a defeat. And in the other way, even our defeat is a victory. That is how very beautifully, you know, mystic poets have said that when you go towards the divine, you have to swim, or rather you have to go through a sea of fire. And they who believe that they are able to swim, strong people, they actually drown. And those who are ready to drown, they arrive. So it's a, you know, the basic thing is about the loss of the ego. Those who want to keep the ego and go to the divine, they don't really reach. They create all kinds of, get trapped into all kinds of illusions. Whereas those who are ready to lose the ego, they find the divine. His mind, a beat in original nothingness, ciphers his... Sri Aurobindo has such wonderful sense of humor. Several places it comes in Savitri. This is a original nothingness. It's a impossibility that out of nothing everything is coming out. Ciphers his thought on a slate of hourless time. He builds on a mighty vacancy of soul, a huge philosophy of nothingness. And this is not enough. The joke continues. In him, Nirvana lives and speaks and acts. This is not, he's not talking about the Trigunatit or, you know, Nistraygunavastha. That's the original, that's the right way. But here, Sri Aurobindo is revealing the paradox. In Savitri, there are so many beautiful, you know, sense of humor and touches. In him, Nirvana lives and speaks and acts. This is a very interesting poem of Sri Aurobindo. I or the ego self. In this poem he says, he said, I am egoless, free. Then swore because his dinner was not ready. I asked him, are you so very sure? He said, it's not me, the belly god that is unsteady. Yeah, there is a whole philosophy. I am not this, I am not the body, I am not this. I have discovered myself. So I am free. It's so easy. If it was so easy, people would not spend decades. They wouldn't say it takes lives. If it was so easy that we just tell it 10 times and abracadabra, now I am the soul and self. So he said, I am egoless, free. Then the moment the dinner was not ready on time, he got very agitated and angry. So he asked, are you sure you are free? No, you are confused. It's not me. It's my belly god. It's an interesting story of a very old-time sadhak who was admitted in Jipmar. You know, it's very difficult. Its mother has provided us a beautiful, wonderful place, protected from all the hardships of the world. This is a unique sadhana. The only hardship is our nature. So we have to confront that. So when the person was admitted in Jipmar, he was very unhappy about this, that, got angry at everybody. And finally the doctor said, you're supposed to be doing sadhana, why are you getting so angry? So he gave a wonderful reply. He said, no, you won't understand, this is part of the sadhana. Man was totally confused. Of course he meant that I have to work upon my nature, but said it very cryptically, very nice. You won't understand, this is part of the sadhana. That all my difficult sides are coming out. So this is the paradox. In him, Nirvana lives and speaks and acts, impossibly creating a universe. That's the whole joke. That everything is coming out of nothing. This is one of the things about Sri Aurobindo's, which takes a dig both at the modern scientific materialism as well as, you know, people who say so-called spirituality, where they say, no, this universe is emerged out of nothing. So Sri Aurobindo is saying, yes, impossibly creating a universe. Something is coming out of nothing. An eternal zero is his formless self, his spirit, the void, impersonal, absolute. This is not about Buddha, because Shobhindu at several places speaks about Buddha. What Buddha has spoken, he refused to say what is that. When people asked him, he said, he refused to define it. Both Mother and Shobhindu have said, Buddha's message has been misunderstood. And at one place, but Shobhindu says in the evening talks, which is very interesting, he says in the Vishnu Purana or Bhavishya Purana, it is mentioned one of the avatars of Vishnu comes by the name of Maya Moha, referring to Buddha. And his role is to take the asuras out of creation. Because you know, asura is very attracted to nothing. So Buddha did not reveal what is that, but people put that nothing. But it's the same thing as the Advait, the one, the permanent, the absolute. But if Buddha would have said, again people would have reduced it to their own meaning into it. So when people went and said, the famous story is that somebody went to Buddha and said, I believe you have been saying that there is God. So Buddha said, is it? Why? He said, I don't believe in God. So Buddha said, but I didn't say there is God. It's all right if you don't believe in God. So he went away very happy, telling people that Buddha doesn't believe in God. So another person said, he said, you say that you don't believe in God. So he said, why are you asking me? He said, because I believe there is God. He said, okay, keep seeking and find. So he also goes away. So the disciple who is hearing, he's saying, what is it? Do you believe or you don't believe in God? So who is right? Is this person right or that person right? So Buddha gave a very interesting reply. He said, both are right. So this man again doesn't know what does Buddha mean. He said, both are right. The first one who said there is no God is also right. And the second one who said there is God is also right. So God of our own making, our own images, they are images which help us to prolong. And there is the divine reality beyond it. So both are right in their own regard. So here it's not about that. But people who have turned it into a doctrine of nothingness. So he's saying, take not that stride, O growing soul of man. Cast not thyself into that night of God. The soul's suffering is not eternity's key, or ransomed by sorrow heaven's demand on life. So it's very interesting that some people get into, or you know, in the course of yoga, a point may come when people may go through a difficult patch. And then they try to please the divine through tears. And then when the divine doesn't listen or doesn't respond, of course he responds to tears which flow from the heart with deep trust in the divine. But there is another kind of tears where you don't listen to me, and then the complaining, and then the more we complain that you don't exist, we put a veil between ourselves and the divine. As the mother says, when you come complaining and grumbling, then all kinds of adverse forces enter us. So that also we think it's a movement of sadhana, that we are after all going to mother, but we are full of that anguish, full of that complaining attitude, and it comes as a wheel. So even when the divine is there, we can't see. And we go into more and more depression, because there was the original depression. Now added to it is our own belief, whispered by the Titan, that there is actually no divine. He is not listening to me after all. So this is a root. There are so many roots the Titan can push us into. One of these roots is, see, where is the divine? He is not listening to you at all. So even if he is listening, even if he is, so he'll make us blind to the little touches, to the many small touches of the divine, even big things, that is leading us towards him. And we will only see those things which make us believe that there is no divine. So then the soul suffers. So there are so many ways, physical suffering, even suffering, psychological suffering. This is not the path. The divine doesn't want us to go to his room weeping and crying with hankies in our, and people's shoulder on which we are leaning. That's not the way to go to the divine. It's a celebration. It's a utsav. It's a festival of delight. We are going to the home of all loving and the all beautiful. It should be a joyous journey, not a journey full of tears. So this is where He says that is not the path. This is the opposite of the sunlit way of the psyche. O mortal, bear, but ask not for the stroke. So human mind can create all kinds of perversity. You know, pain is makes us closer to God. And pleasure is a deception. So Lord, give me pain. Now Sri Aurobindo is saying, please don't turn this great truth into a perverse philosophy. I want pain so that I can remember. Are you can remember even in joy. So pain is anyways part of life. Certain amount of pain is in everybody's life. We don't have to ask for extra pain. This is morbidity. It's almost like loving pain. So he says, bear the pain, but don't ask that, you know, if you strike me, that is the best thing. Too soon will grief and anguish find thee out. Too enormous is that venture for thy will. Some may try it. It's okay. And go through it. But for most, this is not the path. It's a dangerous path. Only in limits can man's strength be safe. That's why there are limits within which we are there. And now Sri Aurobindo brings a very interesting turnaround. From this it seems the logic would be that okay, man has to remain within limits. But the very next line is, yet is infinity thy spirit's goal. And now he reveals a very beautiful gospel. And this is another truth of Sri Aurobindo, that many persons have tried to explain this world and its suffering and its origin on the basis of this thought that this world is a creation of desire. It has come out of desire. Now, who desired it? Nobody says. If divine desired, then it's blessed by the divine. Or who could put desire in the heart of Brahman? That is not explained. But world is the creation of desire. This is one kind of philosophy. And therefore, the only solution is to escape from the world. Sri Aurobindo raises this question. What was the desire originally of the soul? The first karma. And Sri Aurobindo follows the other line, the line of the great Upanishads, that this world is not created out of desire, but it's created out of delight. Anandam brahmeti. Atma ananda raso vesaha. There are so many Bhrigavalli in that famous Taittiriya Upanishad, where there is a very beautiful dialogue between Bhrigu and his father Varuni. And the little child asks, tell me about truth. So father is not like, you know, he says, okay, you meditate and tell me. So he meditates and says, I think body is truth. Annam brahmeti. So he says, okay, yeah, I agree, but go still further. So he again meditates. He says, pranam brahmeti. The life force is truth because it moves matter. He says, all right, I don't deny it, but go further. So he goes further and says, mano brahmeti. The thought impels the life force. So that is truth. He says, all right, go further. He says, vijnanam brahmeti. Behind the thought, there is the great idea which even sends thought on its errands. All right, go still further. Just one more step and you will discover the ultimate reality. And he comes back and says, anandam brahmeti. He says, good. Graduation degree conferred on to you. This is the truth. So this is the whole. Now the beauty of this little dialogue in Taittiriya Upanishad, Bhrigavalli, is that it doesn't deny the other levels. It includes and absorbs them ultimately and leads it towards ananda. It doesn't deny it. There are steps of the ascent. So he doesn't say annam brahmeti or telling a lie, it's false. No, it's not false. There is a truth behind it, but it's not the ultimate truth. It's a limited truth. So here again we will see Sri Aurobindo revealing this truth in his own way. Yet is infinity thy spirit's goal. Its bliss is there behind the world's face of tears. A power is in thee that thou knowest not. Thou art a vessel of the imprisoned spark. It seeks relief from time's envelopment. So now he is revealing to us the deepest cause of pain. It's very interesting that up to a point, we can experience pain within limits. Then when the time comes to transcend those limits, the type of pain begins to change. Then by transcending those limits, we are again free of the pain. There is a pain within those limits, the new limits, and so on. So we see in humanity, when people are living only at the level of the flesh, the only thing that pains is maladies of the flesh. Other things don't pain. But as we grow in consciousness, we become more sensitive. We become pained not only with pain of our inner being, but pain of others. Through sympathy, we begin to be, you know, tied by a kind of inner cord. That means the time has come for us to take the next leap. So this is how pain is, because the imprisoned spark. Now, why there is sympathy? Because the soul has developed to a point where it can somewhere begin to glimpse its universal self. That I am not just alone. I am part of a huge, vast cosmic self. And then it begins to reach out to others, feels one with the cosmic self, and indirectly in nature it takes the form of sympathy. That means, and people suffer. As we grow in consciousness, the nature of suffering begins to change. And it's an indication that the leap is ready. Now this suffering, if we go deep inside, is because the soul is growing, but the vessel is too small. And that is what is revealed in the story of King Satyavrata. That he goes, the first Matsavta, that he goes, and after all his prayers, he sees a little fish who says, O king, please take me to your palace and give me some place to stay. Because, you know, the sea is very threatening. So he says, okay. He takes the fish in his kamandalu and puts the fish, and as he is walking away, the fish again says, O king, I have grown bigger, please give me another place. So he puts it in a bigger aquarium. So as he moves and starts walking, O king, I am growing bigger and bigger, give me another place. So the king says, what to do? So he puts the fish in a nice pond. So once again the fish shouts, O king, please, the pond is smaller. So he takes the fish and puts back into the river. Now the story is, what is this whole journey? And then the fish says that, look, I am basically God Vishnu, who has come here to tell you that Pralaya is going to come, and on the seventh day Pralaya will come. So you make a boat, put all the creatures, pairs, and I'll come to rescue the boat. Now the rest of the story for the moment is not important. But the interesting part is that as consciousness develops, the form, by form is not just the physical body also, the vital body, the mental body, all this must also grow to participate in the growth. Otherwise, it feels cramped up inside. So many people go through an existential crisis and they don't understand. It presents in the form of depression. But actually it's an existential crisis. They want to expand. And I believe today's children are fairly developed souls. That's why they say, one of the things they say, we need more space. And they need psychological space. Because it's true that as we develop, we need space. People feel crammed up if they are in, even physically we need more space. So that's how we have to grow step by step. So it seeks relief from time's envelopment, this little spark which it grows. And while thou shuttest it in, the seal is pain. So when we don't follow this inner voice, this inner leading, and we shut ourselves into the small, narrow, either the routine of life or the old way of life, then it makes us suffer a lot. It's amazing that, you know, when we have a calling, we must follow it. This is a very strange story of, you know, someone who was here and then eventually went through a, you know, difficult period, got married and had four children, lost all the four children, and asked mother in anguish, mother, why I have to go through all this? Mother said, look inside yourself and you will have the answer. And then the lady said, yes, I had the answer. And of course, she got the answer in many ways, that I was meant to lead this life, but I went through, you know, some kind of experience of world and all this, and eventually you come back. Because you can never be satisfied. This is the whole theme of that famous Francis Thomas poem, The Hound of Heaven. That wherever one goes, this hound pulls the person out. So if we shut this call of the soul inside, it will only bring more and more pain and suffering. Even if circumstances are very fine, even if outer situations are good, yet there will be suffering. Because it's the suffering for the soul to emerge, like the bird wanting to emerge out of the cage. Bliss is the Godhead's crown, eternal, free, unburdened by life's blind mystery of pain. Bliss is the crown. At the end of the journey, what awaits us? Bliss. Not some blank knot, not some cold, impersonal reality, not some harsh, bare truth. What a wonderful thing. What waits us at the end? Anandamay. The divine who is all bliss, raso vesaha. It should give us extra impetus on the journey. So this where, in fact, it's very interesting that Krishna is regarded as someone who draws all the souls towards him very naturally. That's the symbol of gopis and gopes, gop and gopis. Now Krishna is anandamay. And the name Krishna literally means that which draws all things towards itself. That's how we have akarshan, vikarshan, sankarshan, all born from that root Krishna. So that being of bliss, who is the crown, draws all things towards himself. When we go slowly, then we go through pleasure and pain. When he draws forcibly, then sometimes we feel, oh my God, it's too intense. It may give pain, but actually it's the sudden drawing towards himself. Pain is the signature of the ignorance, attesting the secret God denied by life. So, what is the sign that we are really free, that we have arrived a state of peace and inner joy, bliss, delight? This is what is the sign. It's not about external circumstances. External circumstances may be any kind. Shubhendu was asked that, does it mean that those who follow the sunlit path, they will have no difficulties? He said, no, they also have difficulties, but they go through it in a state of peace and joy, with a state of surrender. Outer difficulties, events, circumstances, they will come. Even inner nature difficulties, don't bog them out. They don't go into, you know, seas of despair, because they have discovered that root bliss which they touch and eat every day. That is why the soul is also called as the eater of the bliss. So to have found the soul means to every day eat a little bit of that bliss and be eaten by it. So that is the sign. But pain is the signature of the ignorance, attesting the secret Godhead denied by life. So how does pain attest the Godhead denied by life? Pain comes to tell us, you know what? Your goal is not just this. Your goal is bliss. So it attests. Not yet, not yet. How beautifully Shubhendu has an amazing way to, you know, reveal such secrets to us. Until life finds him, pain can never end. So he is a fellow who walks by our side, keeps reminding us, giving a nudge here and there. No, no, don't rest. Don't be happy with your comfort zone. You look, I am there, no? If I am there, that means you have not arrived. So it's so nice, beautiful, this fellow. But we should not ask for this fellow. He has a role to fulfill. When his role is over, then he'll say, tata, bye-bye, I am off. My job is done. He'll himself leave. Calm is self's victory overcoming fate. Once again, Savitri, there are two levels at which she conquers death. One, when she says, oh death, I have triumphed over thee within. This is the first victory. The first victory is a state of calm, peace, tranquility, equanimity in the face of danger, in the face of disaster, in the face of death, in the face of diseases. So calm is self's victory overcoming fate. And when we do it, paradoxically, the circumstances themselves begin to change. Because that is the secret. They discover that we can't threaten this fellow. So they begin to change, more aligned with the inner truth. bear, thou shalt find at last thy road to bliss. So beautiful it is. Shivindu is not saying try, thou shalt find at last, bear. The road will come, the path will open. The hand, outstretched hand of God will come and pull us out. This is the trust we should keep. Bear. At last thou shalt find thy road to bliss. Bliss is the secret stuff of all that lives. Even pain and grief are garbs of world delight. The same actor wears different dresses. It hides behind thy sorrow and thy cry. How does it hide? Why do we really feel sorrow? Because we cannot accept an imperfect state. That's why we are suffering. Because we want things to be beautiful. Because we want things always to be happy, harmonious. The end should be harmonious. The journey should be harmonious. This is inbuilt. We are programmed for that. When we don't see it, we cry. So this is where it hides behind thy sorrow and thy cry. So, but why does it come? Because thy strength is a part and not God's whole. Because afflicted by the little self, thy consciousness forgets to be divine as it walks in the vague penumbra of the flesh and cannot bear the world's tremendous touch, thou criest out and sayest that there is pain. This is the logic. Now he is revealing to us the greatest secret. The more limited we are, the more we suffer. The vaster we grow, the less we suffer. So pain comes to one, elbow us out of the comfort zone to break the limits. There are limits in which human consciousness is trapped. We don't realize it. We think it's natural. We even want it to be like that. And we have to expand, grow. So because we limit, and we limit most of all by falsely identifying ourselves with the body. But when we don't identify with the body, this is not me, this is one of the ways, there are so many other ways, then quite naturally, even when the body is going through difficulty and struggle and pain, the consciousness is free and rejoicing. That's what Bulle Shah says, the famous saint poet, that even when my body is tortured, and each drop of blood is falling on the ground, I dance to the tune of thy love. Karke chhaiya chhaiya. That's how I dance. Because it's feeling rejoice. Because in everything it feels the touch of the divine lover. All around it sees nothing else but an embrace of God. That is a very vast state. Like Sri Aurobindo says, my rival's downfall is my own disgrace. I look at my enemy and see Krishna's face. The Titan is just the opposite. He looks at Krishna and sees his enemy's face. God is bad. He punishes me. He is cruel. He sends tortures to me. This is called the other way. Looking at God and seeing one's enemy's face. But the other way is looking at the enemy and seeing the face divine. So this is the journey. So if we are limited, we have to grow into vastness. Indifference, pain and joy, a triple disguise. This is a beautiful image. And an image which is, even spiritually, shows a path. Indifference, pain and joy, a triple disguise. Attire of the rapturous dancer in the ways. Withhold from thee the body of God's bliss. What an image. It's uplifting sensuousness to divine heights. Pain, indifference and pleasure, these are attires. The rapturous dancer has worn, and we get too much bogged down by the attire. We either appreciate it or we are repelled by it. But if we could tear the mask, the garb, and go deep inside, we will discover the same bliss. So there is a very interesting prayer of the mother, where she says that when we suffer from anguish of separation, Actually, it is when mother leaves Geneva and she's feels the pain of those who are feeling pained at her going. We can imagine that. And she says, this suffering is in ignorance a way, this suffering and attachment is in ignorance a way to create the sense of oneness, because oneness is the truth. Then she says, instead of suffering helplessly, if we know how to go deep down into suffering, neither ask for it nor shun it when it comes, but to go deep into it, we would discover oneness and the suffering would cease. So that is the way, that when it comes our way, we should not ask for it. Oh, suffering come, let me see. No. Anyways, it's kota, it will come. So when it comes, instead of running away, hiding from it, because again it will come in one form or the other, to go deep into it and recover the oneness that we have lost. So we will discover once again delight. And Sri Aurobindo has shown it with his own life example. Look how he talks about his days in the jail. One cannot imagine, it's an amazing document at different levels. One is of course about the conditions of the jail. He also takes a dig at the British Empire and its so-called impartiality. But more importantly, he reveals to us really that here is the yogis of yogi in the jail. What is he talking about? There have been great beings who have gone to jail. Abdul Baha was one of them, or rather Baha'u'llah. But here is Sri Aurobindo's document where he says that, what is this jail? And he says that, you know, I learnt yoga, just one thing which I remember. How the jail is a perfect place to learn yoga. And he says that they had mastered the art of preparing khichdi in three different ways. So one was, you know, very dark, some liquid. So he said that is the tamasic mode. He said all about yoga one could learn there. The other was a little yellowish and peppered with little bit spice. That was the rajasic mode. A third one was with some lentils, but the same lentils over and over again. And he says that was the sattvic mode. And one day it would be pure white, like the snow white purity of Shiva. And there would be jaggery in it. He said that was something edible. And he says, so many things I learned. And he's sparkling humor. And he says, another thing I learned, like the one Brahman becomes many things. So I discovered when they gave me one lota, that was a multi-purpose gadget. So one could use it to drink water, for bathing, for ablutions, for whatever one wanted. It was the universal lota. So he says, it reminded me and taught me practically how the one Brahman becomes many. Now, you know, who could get that lesson from the lota? One lota is given to him and the Lord has discovered Brahman there. No wonder he was seeing Vasudeva. We are unhappy even with five lotas, because the neighbor has a sixth one, which is little bigger and better. So, you know, he says that attire of the rapturous dancer in the ways withhold from thee the body of God's bliss. So then what will happen to these three emotions? Thy spirit strength shall make thee one with God. If you walk bare, that's why strength is required to walk the path. Because things will come. We have to keep walking undeterred, steady, with eyes fixed towards the goal. Thy agony shall change to ecstasy. Why? Because agony is a self-limitation. So pain will change into tears of joy. Thy agony will shall change to ecstasy. Indifference deepen into infinity's calm. So these are the shadows, the distortions of a great truth. And joy laugh nude on the peaks of the absolute. So this is the bliss which is behind all creation. And this is our goal towards which we go. And that is why the journey should be happy, because the end is not a vacant knot. The all blissful. And that is why one has to renounce the lesser things on the way, not the lesser permissible truths which Shobinda speaks of, but the lesser joy and pain. Nothing should hold us back so that we can go faster. We also cling to pain. Oh, you know, 10 years back what happened in my life? That moment is gone. But we don't let it go. We are holding on to it. So we don't let go of pain. And of course, we don't let go of pleasure. So we cannot reach bliss. That's why the Upanishad, Ish Upanishad says that Tena Tyaktena Bhunjitha Magridha Kasya Siddhana. By renouncing, thou shalt enjoy. So all renunciation is for a greater joy. It's not for suffering and pain. This is what people don't understand. So they have this feeling that when people come to ashram, oh my God, how much you have renounced. Oh, you left a lucrative career. There was money. Oh, you joined an ashram life with a pulled long face. So you have to tell them, no, we are very happy. We have learned to feel so much joy. We can smile from the heart. You have renounced. And you don't realize it. You have renounced the delight of the mother and her love and her lap and her joy and her peace, and are thinking that these things will, and you know, chosen to wallow in pleasure and pain. But this is not renunciation. This is a greater bliss. What else can one want or seek in life? So we'll stop here.